My name is Karen Gallivan. I'm a senior industry analyst and tax partner with RSM US LLP, a provider of tax, audit, and consulting services to the middle market. I'm honored today to have Victoria Butson with me. She joined Bain Capital in 2021 as Senior Vice President and Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Prior to that, she was the co-founder and executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and has done extensive work in advocating for diversity and inclusion and for women in the workplace in the public, private, and academic sectors. Welcome today, Victoria.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you've done extensive work advocating for women in the workplace. What motivated you to begin working in this space?
I'm someone who always thought it seemed odd that our world was divided based on gender, based on race. So even when I was a young child, it seemed as arbitrary as having redheads play football and people with brown hair play soccer. It just seemed a funny way to structure the world. So I've always been interested on different ways that we could build gender equity and racial equity. And how could we create an environment where each and every person could make their full contribution, whatever field or sector they were interested in?
You know, when you talk about the facts about it, according to the World Economic Forum, in its global gender gap report for 2020, they say gender parity will not be attained for another century. And the pandemic only compounded the income and wealth struggles for women. Why do you think the pandemic caused such a major setback?
The pandemic really exacerbated and highlighted the problems that we have. And it just deepened, in essence, trenches of behaviors that already take place, whether that's in the workplace or at home. And in some ways was a perfect storm where you had women who had made gains within industries, but because women continue to need to do a second shift, I'm often aware that I do the full job, in essence, that my father did, meaning that I'm a primary breadwinner, and the full role that my mother did, meaning that I'm a primary caregiver. And many women across societies throughout the world have both of those roles. And what the pandemic did is it created a situation where women's caregiving increased, because caregiving that took place within the home became a 24/7 situation, where many individuals who are parents prior had the opportunity for their children to be cared for in school or to be cared for within daycare or a creche system that was no longer available to people with the pandemic. Women's roles at work continued and women's roles at home increased. So you had a rise in both at the same time. When women historically are in a position where the needs of family rise, they rise to meet it. Now note, there's sometimes discussion that these things are predetermined or biologically destined. We don't see evidence of that. What we see is that people in society function in the ways that are expected and required of them. And historically, continuing to today, the requirements of care have gone up and women have met those needs. We have to ensure that the whole safety net around care for dependents, whether that's children, whether that's elder care, whatever people's needs are, whatever familial needs are, that all of our employees have access to services to support that. Number two, we need to make it easy. What is the commute for people to come into work? How can we build in flexibility? And also, how do we structurally ensure that we provide all of our employees opportunity? Historically, there's some patterns that when individuals return from parental leave, that people will have what's called benevolent bias, where they might be like, oh, I'm sure that person is so busy, I'm not going to give that female worker who's just returned from leave a big stretch assignment because I don't want her to have too much with the care responsibilities at home. We all know that those stretch assignments are the pathway to promotion. How do we ensure that we're continuing to give all of our workers those opportunities? And number two, how do we create systems that can be flexible, whether that's on-site childcare, whether that's systems and services to provide advice or matching for elder care.
And I had a colleague who was a consultant, and he had a team, and both women were on maternity leave and came back. And I said, oh, how are things going? He said, oh, I'm exhausted. I just keep doing all the travel because I'm sure they just don't want to do it because they're home with their newborns. And I looked at him and I said, did you ask them? You just have to have those conversations to figure out some of those steps that you've outlined for us.
Yeah. And I'll just note, there's a few best practice tools. For example, when people return, for them to sit down with their manager and have a real direct conversation. I'm ready to dial up, or I need a dial neutral, or I need a dial down time, and to be very direct about what the expectations are. And in best in class organizations, the manager then communicates clearly to the team. For example, Karen has just returned from leave. She's going to return to leading X, Y, and Z project. She's going to be the tip of the spear on these next three initiatives, that there's a clear signal that we value that employee. There's some organizations, as part of their best in class work, they review every individual who's come back from parental leave. Are they at a point where they're ready for promotion? But there's both the clear signals to the team and the clear signals to the employee that they're valued and that their contribution should continue.
We always hear all the time that more diverse organizations are also more successful and profitable. Since it really is the case, why then do you think shrinking the gender parity gap isn't shrinking faster?
Well, what we know in the factscape is often not what governs our sets of behaviors. And there's also momentum and inertia. So most organizations tend to function as they have functioned in the past, whether or not it is in the most sort of rational set of actions. So one of the things that one wants to do is to begin by doing an assessment. What is the benchmarking for our industry? What do we see as the talent that is currently there? And then to benchmark the sources from which we recruit. For example, in the private equity industry, it's very common to recruit both out of business schools as well as out of undergrad for analyst program, and perhaps also from consulting or banking or from other firms. When we are only building in a pipeline which considers the percentages from those other institutions, we tie our own hands a little bit. So we want to make sure that we both see what talent is currently out there and are there new sources that we can look to or approach. Many organizations are using partners, whether that's out for undergrad to help with our recruiting in the LGBT community, whether that's management leaders for tomorrow, whether that's Seize Every Opportunity, SEO, Girls Who Invest, Out Investor, Out for Undergrad, Level 20, and there's many, many more. But there are partners that can help organizations get it right and can cut down on that work. And of course, organizations need to remember that as they build those pipelines, they're building systems that will become well-organized, high productivity systems that you don't need to keep building anew with each hire. In addition, one of the challenges that has come up is we've done a great job as an industry of breaking down barriers to entry. We'll often bring in, when we bring in a whole analyst class, we're very conscious that we want diversity, people from different backgrounds, different skill sets, perhaps different regions, and perhaps different nationalities, people who speak different languages. But when it comes to promotion, we tend to choose what replicates the status quo, what is like ourselves, or what is just common within the industry. And though that often can yield good talent, it will not consistently yield the best talent. Organizations that are more diverse tend to perform better for two reasons. One, we know that complex questions are best answered from diverse perspectives. You're more likely to get it right. Simple questions, you really don't need a diverse group. You may have a diverse group from a moral or ethical frame, but you don't need it to get it right. But complex questions we do, and the more perspectives and backgrounds represented within the group answering the question, the more likely we are to get it right. And the second piece that can happen is when organizations are doing that promotion, which is often one at a time, rather than looking across a broad section of individuals in an analyst class, sometimes we're in a rush. Sometimes we make assumptions. And best-in-class organizations don't just look at an individual and say, is John ready for promotion? Or is Martha ready for promotion? Or is Lucretia ready for promotion? Instead, they look at all possible individuals at that grade who could be promoted. They have a core set of predefined experiences, education, performance, and other metrics. And then they literally do the work of filling in that Excel grid. Because what happens is when we have the conversation of, are they ready? Or like when we recruit, are they the right fit? What we tend to do is gloss over the facts. We don't do it on purpose, but all of our minds work that way. And so by doing that work of breaking down and using a metrics-based system, we're much more likely to get it right. So we want to build in structural success, not just try to de-bias ourselves. One, it's a long process. And two, there's not a lot of evidence that de-biasing ourselves as individuals yields really different results.
When we talk about people taking leave and having that flexibility, if that flexibility is not there, then it's sometimes hard to meet some of that criteria. You know, for example, I know when, you know, networking is always a very big part of any, you know, PE or investment firms or even accounting firms, anything in the financial space. But if you don't have time to do that networking, then you're never going to be able to fill in that box. And if no one's going to bring you along, then you aren't going to have that skill set. So I think there has to be things within your everyday that make sure that people have the opportunity to check those boxes.
Karen, you're exactly right. That mentorship and sponsorship, along with that networking, is key to helping people successfully navigate their careers. One of the things which organizations can do is to go right from that onboarding work into a mentorship or sponsorship program. One of the things that can happen with people who aren't the norm in a position is they're less likely to get that real-time feedback so that they can course correct or gain new skills, and that sponsorship relationship where someone in essence is looking around the corner can tell you about opportunities you might not be able to see. What they can do is really identify, here are the key skills that you're going to need to make it to that next level, and can also, of course, match people with opportunity. And sometimes there's kind of that myth of having the perfect mentor or the perfect sponsor or having those long-term relationships. And one of the ways one can really approach is to really think of it more as, who could help me today? Who could help me about this particular issue? Even if it's a moment in time, rather than, you know, what everyone aspires to, which is that long-term meaningful relationship, one can have in essence a micro sponsorship experience or a micro mentorship experience. And there's also peership. People tend to skip the learning that they can do from others right at their level who might be slightly ahead or have had some varied experience that they can learn from.
Absolutely. I always call that my personal board of directors, right? Some people either within your organization that are, you know, close to your level or just ahead that you can just talk to and get ideas from. And also people outside your organization, just to give you a different perspective that isn't necessarily biased to the culture that you're working in. With that, we've seen investors really requiring more from companies than just saying they have DEI initiatives. So how do companies as a whole move from kind of just saying that they have these policies in place to really acting those out or walking the talk?
I believe that leaders want to get it right, and organizations wish to deepen both their diversity as well as their equity and inclusion and the sense of belonging that comes from it. But they don't know exactly what to do, how to do it, or how much time it will take, what it will cost, where they should begin, how to scale it, and to really build that virtuous flywheel. So with each action, they're learning. So the first step is really doing that internal diagnostic. Just the way when you go to the grocery store, you're going to have a list because you're going to need certain ingredients in order to bake a cake. you are going to make sure with your diversity, equity, and inclusion that you understand what it is you're trying to create before you start doing programming and activities. Sometimes people just say, you know, we'll do a bunch of activities and programming and we'll measure some things. And one can do that, but you're not likely to get that high yield result, nor are you likely to understand what is contributing to your effective reaching of KPIs or major business objectives, and what is just some nice to haves. So you want to begin by doing that diagnostic work so then you can see where you need to goal set. It might be that you have representation, but you're not harnessing the diversity of ideas which your team could avail you of because you need better inclusion practices and people need to have more voice. It might be that you haven't been able to capture diverse talent and through the building of pipeline programs, working more effectively with your recruiters, changing where and how you advertise your roles, you could capture a broader, more effective set of a talent force to join your organization. It may be that you can hire in and that you're able to get some of that inclusion, but you lose people past, let's say, level 7. And right before one moves from VP to MD or what have you, you're having people choose to leave. And then you need to work on a retention strategy. You want to get your finger on the pulse so your metrics are guiding you towards action. Once you've done that metrics piece, you want to build out a strategy. Your strategy should not be off to the side. Your strategy should support your core business objectives. Diversity, equity, and inclusion, in addition to a really important moral and ethical framework of how you want to operate, it's also a tool. It is a set of arrows within your quiver that you can effectively build your business, whether it's entering new markets, whether it's developing new products, whether it's supporting your portfolio companies. You want to then have that strategy and align your programming, your inclusion activities, your employee resource groups, all of your activities so that you're building moving forward. In addition, it's really helpful to have an engagement survey, which can provide your organization. You can include a set of inclusion questions so that you have the direct knowledge of how people are experiencing the organization. You can then see whether you have pockets of really high success where people feel inclusion and belonging. And you may be able to draw best practice from those and look at areas that might need some work. As our communities of LPs and others are asking questions of private equity and alternative asset management organizations, we're really in a learning journey together. Which questions guide us to what actions? What additional questions may be very useful? How, as a global community within alternative investments, can we share best practice and not just learn from each other, but learn from models in other industries as well.
I do think many companies, you know, they have it in their strategy. They have their hearts in the right place, like you said, and they're even trying from initial pipeline building to make sure that they're getting those diverse perspectives. But then when you go back to that, if you don't have any metrics set up, it's really difficult to then be accountable and hold the rest of the organization accountable to really make some change.
I think that's exactly right. Both accountability, but also then benchmarking against our industry. So as we do better as a whole industry, where do we fit within that? What else should we be looking at? And how to ensure we aren't counting for counting's sake? Sometimes we can get into the habit in any organization or in any industry of counting what's easier to see. Within engagement surveys, one of the core things I suggest is that you look across all of the questions and see when you disaggregate that information, do you have differences by gender? Do you have differences by office? Do you have differences by language spoken? Do you have differences by generation? And see what you can learn and glean from it. Meeting our workforce where they are in building our efficacy is this ongoing process. There's some really great reports and research coming out about how different generations are engaging in the workplace as we return to office and what those expectations are and which who's geographically rooted and who thinks it would be great if we were only You know, if we had no FaceTime in the office. And it, you know, of course, it for most organizations and industries will take a combination of both to really be at our best.
I know that that you've spoken on panels before directly to the House of Representatives. And so from a public policy standpoint, is there anything else that can be done that you think would be helpful to make sure that people have reached really equity?
You know, that's a really phenomenal question. And I'll just say broadly, when we look both in the US and abroad, all nations continue to have differentiation and a lack of full equality under the law for people with differences, meaning men and women don't hold, for example, the same rights across every nation and across every state or province, and to some extent, even in localities. So we want to remain aware of how do we bring our legal structure and framework up to date so that each and every person has the same set of protections, the same set of opportunities, and the same ability to contribute to society. My framework is always one of how do we remove barriers for people to fully contribute, which is a slightly different lens than what am I entitled to and what does my status as whatever I may be impact that. So I think both are really important. And I think what we'll see ahead from a regulatory framework here in the United States, for example, is more attention paid to the actual tools that our organizations within alternative asset management and the finance industry as a whole are applying. So to say we have a statement or an aspiration, which may have been enough years ago, will give way more fully to an expectation of show me how you are making progress, demonstrate the tools that you are applying, and how are you holding people accountable. One more note on accountability that I'll also add. Many engagement surveys are written where, in essence, the employee is the consumer. How am I experiencing the culture? Do I feel a sense of belonging? And I think that should be married to phrasing and language of saying that people also rate themselves for how am I contributing to the culture of inclusion? What are the action steps that I am taking so that my colleagues feel a sense of belonging, feel that their voices and different opinions or perspectives are valued?
From a personal standpoint, as women, we've all been encouraged to lean in, and leaning in does only go so far though. So what are some other things that we can do really daily to make sure that we're building that more diverse culture in our own organization?
That is a great question. And I'm going to quote a colleague of mine several years ago who said, if I lean any further, I'm going to tip over. And I think that though certainly each of us may have opportunities where we can ask for that stretch assignment, or we can take advantage of opportunity, we want to be aware that within every culture organizationally, asking for more is not always viewed with the same positive response. So number one, we need to educate our whole organization that when individuals are asking for something, that that is a positive thing, as opposed to making more work for one or being aggressive. And in addition, we know that how people hear different things varies. For example, in a job negotiation over salary, the research would show us that if a man says, I believe my skills are worth 10% more, or I would like 10% more, whether or not the hiring manager or officer gives them the 10% more, there is no residual negative effect for the question having been asked. But whereas someone, whether female, whether a person of color, someone who is not the norm in the role, asks for additional compensation, they can often, whether or not they receive that, be viewed as someone who is less desirable with whom to work. So we have to educate everyone within our organizations that difference or asking or that leaning in is positive. Number two, we have to remember that everything we do is intersectional, whether we identify as being female or male or non-binary, that we are also of a geographic region, of an area, of a generation. And as we're working on all of these tools to help our organizations, to help our individual careers, we have to be mindful of intersectionality. So one of the things that we can do is, how are we educating our communities? Most organizations are doing implicit bias training. And implicit bias training is very much like going to the store, to use that same analogy, and bringing home the ingredients. But inclusive leadership practices and having modes and methods of working that are inclusive then turn those ingredients into inclusion and opportunity. So we have to take it to that next level. And then we have to actually look at what are our outcomes. We can't, the idea that we can ask employees to lean in, that's great. But when we measure and see how many women of color, how many men of color, how many individuals then make it from one level to another, that's where the proof is. Sometimes people imagine that DEI efforts, or diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging efforts, are for those employees who somehow are different, whether they're female, whether they're people of color, whether they're first generation, whether they're LGBTQIA. But when diversity, equity, and inclusion is done well, it helps each and every employee. It provides equity, which isn't for some individuals. It's for each and every individual within the organization. So they have the tools they need to progress in their careers. They get the feedback that they need. They're in a position where they have the growth opportunities that they want. So no one should ever feel that they are left out of or not at the center of the discussion for diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. It's for everyone.
Victoria, I cannot thank you enough for your insight. We all, as companies and really people in our own communities, have a lot of work ahead of us, but it's good work. And I think it's only going to bring success if we do it the right way and keep trying.
That's absolutely right. Great pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for the interesting conversation.
Thank you.